Are you going to introduce the podcast?
But you always introduce the podcast.
Not always.
Only when you're not here or something's gone horribly wrong am I allowed to introduce the podcast.
Well, I'm not doing it today.
Are you not?
No.
So you're just going to surprise intro, motherfucker?
Yeah, I'm just going to wait for you.
Burpee test, go!
Pop quiz, hot shot!
Welcome to the latest episode of the Gambling Files podcast. The number one podcast in the gambling industry.
But that sounds good.
Asterix. May not necessarily be true. I am your co-host, Fintan Costello, joined by my co-host, John Bruford. Hello, John.
Hello, Fintan.
How are you?
I am okay. Or as I like to say, like a fine stool, I am passable.
That's all we need in life, mate. Just a passable stool.
That and a good night's sleep and everything's okay.
Everything's, you know what? Everything in life starts with a good night's sleep.
It really does.
I was talking to a friend about this the other day, and he's really getting into the kind of the biohacking type, like really optimizing his, like getting his blood tested for vitamins and also all sorts of stuff. And I'm like, right, okay, let's go. What do I need to take? What do we start doing? Like, do I get tea, HGH? Like, what's going on? He goes, no. This is a tiny, tiny fraction. Let's look at your sleep. And it kind of brought me all the way back to a good night's sleep. So good night's sleep, exercise, plenty of water, no alcohol. And you've probably solved 80%, 90% of the everything. Or good food as well. So it's all the boring basic stuff you got to do all day. I just thought I could fucking take a pill and just shortcut it.
Thing about blood tests and that is, right, that it's a snapshot.
Oh, he's doing it regularly. It's
no, but it's hardcore. But it's still a snapshot. It's a snapshot of what your body is doing right then.
Which is why I'm also looking at continuous glucose monitors right now. I'm very excited.
But your body is constantly adjusting and balancing things. Mm-hmm. And it's a great piece of kit. It's just a shame that we don't realize that until we're too old to undo the things done.
Well, this is the thing, that the body's really good at adapting to stuff. So it'll put up with a lot of the bullshit it gives you, or you give it, until suddenly it doesn't. But what he's doing is really close. He's doing all these regular tests, monitoring his numbers over time, improving things. Mm-hmm. So he's definitely doing it the right way. It's very cool.
Well, that sounds very exciting.
I mean, was excited. Now, we were smashing cocktails at the time we were talking about it, so I don't know how seriously he's taking it. But,
I think you've raised a valid issue there. I think you should probably have a bit of a think.
Well, yeah, true. It was fun, though.
But no, I mean, rest is massively undervalued. And I know that if my sleep is a little bit disturbed, the knock-on effect is colossal. But if my sleep is disturbed, then it means something's really bothering me. So like recent times it's been my sleep's been horrible. And that's a first in my life, and really? it's almost like it's almost debilitating. Do you know what I mean? Because like
it's a torture device. Sleep deprivation is a torture device.
You know, you can't function very well in the day. And if you have a kip in the day, you're absolutely screwed at night. Do you know what I mean? It's just...
I do.
But, you know, it's getting a bit better. So that's something. Found some great sleeping pills.
I'll send you a list. Because it's based on what my friend was saying, I'll send you the list of what you need to do for sleeping. And basically, it's not pills.
Interestingly, though... And this is very interesting. So, as you know, I'm doing the Gaming Boardroom project with Kate Chambers and Greg Saint.
I do.
And one of the things that we're doing is, this is one of the parts that I have yet to develop, but it's very much a part of the roadmap. We're taking an holistic view of life. You know, one of the things that we are going to be looking at in the Gaming Boardroom is the importance of sleep and how to get the best out of it. Not in a kind of that whole, I hate using the word hack. I fucking hate using the word. You know, you see these magazines and they're like, oh, 20 hacks to run faster. Yeah, how about just working really fucking hard?
The one that pisses me off is Growth Hacker. And I'm like, that's called marketing. Do your job.
But anyway. So, yeah, sleep is just one of the things that we're going to be looking at. We're looking at work-life balance, how to handle stress, that kind of thing, how to learn sort of emotional resilience, things like that.
Wow.
Yeah. That's cool.
So well-rounded executive.
Well, yeah, basically, because that's the thing. These are the things that it's actually difficult to learn until they're already going wrong. But if you can have those tools when you're developing, then not only will you be a better worker, a more valuable worker, but you'll also be a really good boss, is what I'm thinking with it.
Is that a hint? Is that the...
Well, you do look tired.
Detoxing.
Retoxing. It's a very, very different act. So that's thegamingboardroom.com. I did a new weekly newsletter on LinkedIn for the boardroom.
Oh, I saw that.
And it's really good. It's because you've got this thing where you've got like a bunch of followers in one place and you want them to look at the other place as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I've got all these followers on LinkedIn because, you know, Kate posts some really, really good content and I'm producing some at the moment. And, you know, you got all this loveliness going on. And, you know, people have a look at that during the day, but you want to say to them, look, you know, if you sign up at the boardroom, there's a free membership. You can get the daily newsletter for free. You can do the community. You can do this, that, and the other for free. And so I thought, actually, let's try and do a bit of engagement on the LinkedIn stuff. And
nice.
So started doing this. So the newsletter on LinkedIn is, it's like my picks of the most interesting stories from the industry for the week, but it's not, it's from all of the media in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
It's not our own stuff. A lot of these are people doing their own,
yep.
Which is, you know, fine. I mean, that's their job sort of thing, but this is us looking at everywhere. Like we had one, sometimes we have stories from casino.org and casino.org. Just occasionally we'll do a really unusual story that's really interesting. And they did one which was about hamster racing streaming on Twitch.
I'm in.
I'm like, this is like the best.
Are they in the, are they like free running or are they like in the little hamster ball thing?
You're just going to have to go and read the story. I think that was in last week's newsletter on LinkedIn. I do it on a Friday morning and we've got, there's a few hundred people signed up for that already.
Lovely.
Yeah, it was really cool. So that was pretty nice. So yeah, www.thegamingboardroom.com.
Get on it.
Right. We are in fact here to, well, we've got to talk about two things really. One, we've got to talk about gamer recruitment solutions. And the other one we've got to talk about is our podcast guest.
Yeah. So who's our podcast guest today, John?
That is a great question, Fintan. This episode, it is returning guest.
Woo 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 woo.
UK gambling law maven Melanie Ellis of Northridge fame. Yeah, I know.
Speechless.
No, that's exactly what happened to me when I realized.
I just can't believe she came back again.
I know.
But I'm really glad she did because she's really good for our numbers. We always get a big boost on that.
Yeah, we do. People love her, don't they?
Yeah.
Probably because she talks a lot of sense.
Yeah, of course. They're not here for us.
No. But Mel's talking about the progress in the consultations for the gambling white paper in the UK, the affordability stuff that's emerged in the last week or so. And I saw Northridge did a takeaway on the recent stuff. So maybe check Melanie out on LinkedIn.
Yeah, she did. She posted 3 one pagers. So there was one page for the affordability checks or the loss checks, one for the slot games changes. So the changes to the game mechanics on the online slot games. And then the third one I saw was for the land-based casinos. So the number of slot machines they can have and the rules around that and adding sports books and all that kind of stuff into their facilities. So super useful.
That is useful.
Yeah, I thought it was great. I was like, oh, this actually just summarizes it neatly into one page. Let's drag it out into a 1-hour podcast.
Yeah, let's do that.
Let's do that.
Well, you know, it could have been printed both sides.
You can increase the playback speed if you want a faster response.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Make a sound probably, like chipmunks.
Yeah, we'd probably sound really good as Alvin and Co. I do quite like Alvin and the Chipmunks.
It's a good cartoon. It's a good cartoon. We should also thank our sponsors.
Yes.
Gaming Recruitment Solutions. GRS-recruit.com.
Yeah.
Why would you call them, John? What would you do?
Well, that's a great question, Fintan. I think if I were looking for maybe a change or a new role and I was working in the gambling industry, they'd be just the kind of recruitment agency that I would want to talk to.
Mm.
If I wanted to move forward, because what I think they'd do is I think they'd talk to me, understand what kind of person I am, and then try to find the fit.
For sure.
Both ways, employer and employee, because you get that fit right and you've got a long-term strategy there, haven't you?
Yeah.
So that's my feeling on it.
This feels right to me. That's right to me. Just looking to hire somebody, looking to get a new job. They've got the gambling industry covered, land-based, senior roles, online, junior roles. It's all there.
Yeah, it's all there. Quite literally.
We would say they're the best recruitment company in the gambling industry. And that's our opinion. I think I can say that. We better check with Mel.
Do you know any of the others?
Yeah, got a couple at the top of my head.
Oh, okay. Because I don't. And I was like, you know, it's a bit of favoritism if it's me, isn't it? But you've got experience.
Yeah, sure.
And you've got experience of being recruited. And I definitely don't have that. So I would say you're a font of knowledge. But Fintan, how would somebody contact?
Go to the website. GRS-recruit.com, probably the easiest way. LinkedIn profile's there. Drop them a note. Say, hey, Paul, it's me. Could we organize a quick chat? And, you know, it's even just having been on their radar, maybe they don't have a role that's a good fit for you right now, but if they know you're in the market or whatever, particularly the more senior you are, there's less roles available, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lead time to this. So kind of planning that into your career change or whatever, and just maintaining those relationships is super important.
Good knowledge. That's indeed. The kind of thing chairmen know.
It's how you get the chairman job, mate.
Ah. I am making notes. Well, I'm recording this. That's the same thing.
It's all about your network.
So, Mel. Yes. Gaming Recruitment Solutions.
Yes.
We missed anything?
That's it.
I could give a little neighbor update. They haven't had any further work done to their drive. There have been no pneumatic tools. It's been nice.
Good. That's really good.
Yes.
Glad we've got everything covered.
The dog seems well. Baby Al had a birthday. I had a birthday.
You did?
But Baby Al's is probably more important than mine.
You didn't tell me about your birthday?
Yeah, middle-ish of July.
Wow.
I got myself a present.
No, I saw your present today.
No. I got myself a present. I got myself a ticket to Heathers the Musical, which I went to see with Lorna.
Lovely.
Oh, it was fantastic. But, you know, it's obviously you don't know what it is.
I haven't got a clue, mate. But I was more the father-daughter time I thought was really nice. And it's a nice night out and all that kind of stuff. So that's more what I was going lovely to, rather than your obscure fucking movie, theater, musical.
Well, it can't be that obscure if somebody made a musical about it and it's been on Broadway in the West End. Can it?
I don't know.
Right. So Heathers is a satire and a black comedy, which was made in about 1989. Launched, I think we say it's pretty much launched the career of Christian Slater. Had Winona Ryder in it as well, and Shannon Doherty, amongst many others. And it's about a girl who is part of a popular clique at school, the Heathers, although she's called Veronica. The other three are called Heather. And Christian Slater's JD turns up at school and turns everything on its head, and together they start killing the popular kids and making it look like suicide. And it's a very, very dark comedy.
Nice.
But it's very, very good. And the musical is extremely witty, and it very much keeps the spirit of the film. But it's really cool because there are a lot of people my age and slightly older, and
surprisingly,
a lot of teenagers. Awful lot of teenagers.
Dragged along by their dads.
No,
watch this, you'll really enjoy it.
The thing is, right, okay, so it's a satire, but it's very transparently a social commentary.
Sure.
It does what it does extremely well. I've heard people ridiculing it. I went and found a podcast because I was looking for something to listen to. It's a podcast called something like the VHS Strikes Back or something. And these guys, like, somebody puts forward an idea for a movie that I'd like them to watch and then discuss. And this guy on his podcast, he actually said, I didn't understand this film. I had no idea what was going on. I'm like, it's a fucking teen film.
Yeah, can't be that hard.
How stupid must this dude be? But that's the thing with satire, isn't it? Satire can be misunderstood. You know, they're making the point that two of the characters in the movie look as though they could easily be 30 years old. Yeah, it's a satire. That's partly what it's satirizing. It is satirizing teen movies. But also, Heathers is the movie that is responsible for my career in publishing. Heathers is the movie that I wrote the essay about that the dude read that then led to me getting my first job on my first magazine.
And here's me being arsy about it. I'm sorry, man. I didn't realize. This was a special one.
But it is also my all-time favorite film.
Really? That's your all-time favorite film?
Yeah, well, I've kind of got three all-time favorites.
Cool.
I've got Heathers.
Yeah.
Amadeus and Starship Troopers.
Okay.
All quite different.
But there's a thread of satire through all of them? Because Starship Troopers was as well, right?
Another seriously misunderstood satire.
Yeah.
Seriously misunderstood film. It's such a clever movie. I love that film. But Amadeus, not so much. The thing about Amadeus is everybody thinks it's biographical. It's not. It's based on a play by Peter Schaffer. It's a play. it has no claims to being, you know, autobiographically accurate. It's not biographically accurate. I mean, it's a dramatic piece.
Yeah.
But the thing about Amadeus, I don't know if you seen Amadeus?
Very long time ago.
So, I mean, it's quite a long film, but the thing that clinches it for me, and it's also the same reason that I have such a deep abiding love for First Blood, the Rambo movie.
Best movies ever.
both that and Amadeus were shot using natural light sources.
Ooh.
Or in the case of Amadeus, it was shot using the same light sources they would have had at the time. And if you recall, you might not recall this, in Amadeus, they have Mozart's operas on stage lit by candles.
Mm.
And the photography is so breathtakingly brilliant that you don't even realize what you're seeing. Because that is a really hard thing to light. There's a scene in First Blood where Stallone is in the disused mine and there's water and he's got his flaming torch and rats are falling on him. The torch is the light source in that scene. And that is an extraordinarily difficult thing to light, artificially.
Mm-hmm.
But to film it, because you've got water reflecting the light, you've got a burning torch and all this, like, that movie is a work of genius. But anyway, okay. By the by. Yeah, that's my favourite movies. But Mel.
On to Mel.
We're joined by today's special, special guest, the perfectly named Melanie Ellis, partner at Northridge. Not Northridge Law, I wasn't going to say that. But the not particularly freshly rebranded, but the Northridge law firm that you are a partner at. Melanie, hello.
Hello, thank you for having me. I don't know if that was confusing.
I don't know either.
Northridge law, either.
Well, but all the branding's gone to Northridge. It's gone like sexy, like, but you know. If you were like, if you went past, like, I don't know, if they got Northridge vans for moving around large amounts of legal documents, you just look at it and go, "Is that a law firm? Is that a, what is that? Is it a florist?"
No, but if you want to go like super trendy, it's taking all the vowels out. That's abbreviating even shorter. Like that's what the real like. Aberdeen did that. Aberdeen did that to whatever it is.
Gavin Isaacs was way ahead of the curve with that one when he did it with Shuffle Master and just made him shuffle SHFL.
Oh, okay.
That would have been, God, I don't know, 12, 13 years ago, I think.
Yeah.
Nailed it. Way ahead of the curve. Man's a genius.
Always is. Always is.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's been some things happening, Melanie Ellis, and I thought you'd be a really good person to talk about those things. But I'm not sure what's been happening. Melanie?
There has been quite a number of consultation topics released by both the Gambling Commission and the government in the last week or so. It's quite a lot of different topics to talk about, so I don't know which ones you think would be of most interest to your.
Let's start with the affordability stuff.
That's the big one, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, and that's the one where there is most kind of detail, really, that's come out of this consultation. The other ones perhaps are a bit more just setting out what we're expecting anyway. So, yeah, I mean, definitely be interested to hear both of your views on the proposals for the financial checks. I could summarise the requirements to start with, if you think that would be helpful.
Bring it on.
Yeah, okay. Let's do that.
Yeah. Okay, or the proposed requirements. So there's, as I think we expected, there's three different trigger points for checks. So the first trigger point is if somebody loses £125 in a rolling 30-day period or £500 in a rolling 365-day period. And this is net losses, so it doesn't matter how much they have deposited. It's just kind of settled bets or gambles. And this is a light touch check where operators will be expected to just do a background check without necessarily contacting the customer other than to ask them for their details of their job. So they'll do a background check for bankruptcies, CCJs, that kind of thing. And they'll look at the average data for the customer's postcode area and the average salary for the job that they've told the operator they do. Based on that, they'll make an assessment and decide to take some sort of proportionate action based on that information, we don't quite know what such proportionate action will be, but presumably limiting the customer's gambling in some way.
I've got the first question, if I can just jump in. Net losses.
Yeah.
So if I deposit 100 and I win 500 and then I lose 300.
Well, it's
I probably should have picked, I probably should have done a bit more. So is it net losses? So it's your deposits minus your
don't
wins?
Know. So deposits,
or
deposits don't actually come into it. So it's how much have you bet?
Mm-hmm.
So at the time that the bet is settled, for example, you put on a £100 bet and it won and you won back £200. Say it was at 2-1.
Yeah.
So now you've got a positive position of £200.
Okay.
Whereas if you bet £100 and it lost, you're now on a minus £100 net losses. So it doesn't matter how much money you've got remaining in your account. It's just winnings.
Or how much you've actually, like, your, because it's okay, it's your net with the bookie, but not your actual net as per your bank statement, for example.
Yeah, that's right. So I guess the idea is if you've got the money in the account with the bookie, you could, in theory, still withdraw that. You know, if you had some unexpected bills come up or something, the money's yours. You
sure.
can take it back.
Sure.
Hopefully.
So what it's actually trying to do then is it's trying to avoid customers just leaving their balances on the account because you're going to trigger the KY. You're going to trigger the source of funds to, or the checks,
I mean,
anyway.
Yeah, but deposits are still going to trigger AML checks. That's, you know, completely
that's
separate.
A good point.
But yeah, for the financial checks, it's really, you know, what has a customer lost? They're never going to get that back because they lost that on a bet or on the slots or whatever. So that's what's triggering the check. So then the enhanced checks come in. Firstly, if somebody's lost £1,000 in a rolling 24-hour period,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, it sounds like quite a lot, I suppose, really, to lose £1,000 in a 24-hour period, but potentially for someone who's a professional gambler, you know, with the ups and downs, it could be triggered. And at this point, the operator has to actually get some data about the customer's financial circumstances in terms of their their account, bank account details of what's coming in and out of their account. They also have to do a sort of a proper credit rating for the customer so that they might get the banking information through open banking or, you know, some sort of similar system, or it could be actually the customer providing their bank statements to the operator. Interestingly, there's no mention of payslips at any point, which is something the Gambling Commission has expected in the past. So really the only time the customer's employment information comes into play is at the light touch check. So they've just asked them to tell them what they do for a living. And then, you know, when you see the bank account data, you'll be looking at money coming in and money going out. You know, obviously you may see a salary as part of that, but there may be other money coming in and out as well.
Which is good, because it feels like by not asking for the pay slips, there could actually be an open banking solution where it's like, a couple of clicks.
Yeah. So for customers that are willing to share their bank statements through open banking with the operator, at least, I guess that makes it a bit easier for them. There's still the barrier of will they be willing to share that level of information with a gambling operator, and you know, probably a number of customers won't want to, understandably. And then, in addition to the net losses, you've also got with this check that if the customer is up in terms of their actual winnings from the past week, that can be taken into account. So they had a win of, you know, £2,000 the previous week and now they're down £1,000, and then the check wouldn't be triggered because they're up 1,000 overall.
Okay.
Now, I mean, another thing to mention about this one is that the customer can carry on gambling with the money they've got on deposit already while these checks are taking place. They just can't deposit any more money. So, you know, you could have a customer who's deposited quite a lot of money in the past, has it all sitting on the account. You know, they could just ignore the risk, the request for the bank statements or open banking and just carry on gambling with the money that they've got on account, in theory.
Could they cancel if they win? Can they cancel out their net losses?
No, because I mean, the check would have been triggered. So once it's triggered, you know, the operator has to do it.
I'm going to punt my way out of this paperwork.
Yeah. I think that might, yeah, that one wouldn't go down well. It's going to take some.
Really short odd stuff.
I'm just glad you're amusing yourself, Fenton.
Well, it's just the way my brain works. It's just like, okay, what's the loophole? Like, how can we drive a bus through this as quickly as possible?
To see the way that, look, say somebody is a professional bettor. They don't like the sound of these checks. They don't want to have to provide their bank statements to the operator. They just want to carry on, you know, hopefully making money. They, you know, that there are potentially ways around it in terms of managing how much you lose with different operators you're registered with, depositing a large amount potentially, and then working your way through that to you know, sort of avoid being limited by further deposits being halted. And this is obviously the risk that you know that there is with setting out precise requirements for checks, that people will then be able to more easily circumvent it. But I, you know, I think overall it's sort of counterbalanced by the benefits. You know, it's
oh, at least for sure it is, because realistically this is for the vast majority. The professional bettors, I think, is such a small group, and realistically they get limited by the bookies anyway because they're a different problem. Particularly if gambling Twitter is to be believed. So there is that kind of, I think it's more, it's not the professional bettors, it's the really rich people that are going to be inconvenienced more than anybody. But then,
That's true.
But then apparently they're all going to Montenegro anyway, so that'll be fine.
Nothing to say to the land base. So
once you hit one of these, you've hit your £1,000 loss, net loss, how long before, like, is it every time you hit £1,000 within a 7-day period, you get another check, or how does this work?
So once the check's been completed, you're basically free for 6 months to continue gambling, and the operator doesn't have to do it again within 6 months. Again, the information that they get from this, they have to use that. So they may well then be saying, well, look, you know, we've seen from your bank statement that your disposable income looks like it's around, you know, whatever, and we're going to limit your gambling accordingly. And that's where the operators are going to get in trouble with the commission, as, you know, as they have done in the past, that they've got this information about the customer and then to actually set an appropriate limit on them.
And then they're not looking, because I suppose there's, all right, I go to Bookmaker One, hit my £1,000, go through the paperwork, get approved for a certain limit, and then that's it for 6 months. And then I'm not happy with that, so I now go to Bookmaker Two, open a second account, or refund it. Everyone's got multiple accounts, go to another. So you could really see this kind of just spreading money around multiple accounts if you're not happy with a limit.
And you know, that's the case anyway. It's just that operators obviously have different limits and different approaches that they've taken. So I think a big benefit of it for operators is at least they have the certainty that their competitors, at least their licensed competitors, are, you know, doing the same sort of things at the same times. So there won't be that feeling of, well, this is so unfair that I'm having to do this check when, you know, whatever
no one
other
else
bookmaker, I know they're letting people play, you know, hundreds of thousands.
Which, yeah, and that's definitely based on the fines that get issued sometimes. I suppose the follow-up to that then is, will there be, like, if we're talking about that level playing field, then will there be, here is the rules for setting these limits? Or is it like a outcomes-based, up to the reader to figure it out?
Yeah, as far as I've seen so far, it is going to be for the operator to then make appropriate decisions based on the information. They have to take those decisions manually. You can't just be an automated process, according to the proposals. That's where it's going to continue to be difficult decisions for operators to, you know, what's an appropriate limit. But at least the frustration of having to ask for bank statements, you know that you're doing it at the same point as others.
Yeah, and it, realistically, for the vast majority, it's going to be fine in terms of like the limits and these kind of things. And then even if you go back to the VIP example, if I am a VIP and I've done my thing once, I know, okay, I only have to do this every 6 months and they're going to leave me alone. Which is, from a P&L perspective for the bookie, probably actually the best outcome.
I think that's good. And then, the final type of check to mention is the more of the long-term losses. So this is £2,000 loss in 90-day period. And this and the previous one are both going to have a half of that amount for under 25 players as well. It's worth bearing in mind. But potentially that could be triggered more often potentially than £1,000 in 24 hours. I'm not sure. Again, you do the check once and then it doesn't have to be done again for 6 months. So.
Okay.
I think that's probably all there is to say on those at the moment.
But it got quite confusing quite quickly in there, I felt. Only when Fintan started talking. Up until then, it was crystal clear.
That's why I'm not a lawyer. basically, it's what does this mean? So this is like, right, here's a first draft up for debate. Let's get everybody's feedback, or is this pretty much what's going to happen?
Yeah, I think it's pretty much what's going to happen. Sometimes the commission will make small changes to proposals based on feedback, but I think it would have to be somebody coming up with sort of an unforeseen result of what's being proposed that's actually to the detriment of customers potentially. That sort of feedback could lead to some slight changes. Otherwise, I imagine it's going to come in pretty much as proposed. In terms of timing, I would guess it's going to be sort of spring next year. So we've got till mid-October to get responses in. The commission then needs at least a couple of months to think through the responses they've had. And the more responses they get, obviously, the longer it will take. So then it will be the end of the year or early next year by the time they then set out, this is what we're going to put into force and this is when it will come into force. And then they'll give operators a bit of time to implement things. So, but I would imagine by this time next year, it will be enforced probably a little bit earlier. Depends a bit, I think, on the volume of responses and whether there's any kind of particular issues I didn't think of that they have to then try and solve.
Got it. Okay.
Do you think that? I mean, it's kind of pleasing that a lot of stuff has emerged already, and surprising. Do you think that the time frame is more realistic given how they've moved quickly early doors, or do you think this is? I mean, I still think it's wildly ambitious. To look at, was it next summer?
Yeah, I think to achieve everything in the white paper within the time frame is ambitious, but this particular piece, the commission already had all of this kind of set out. They'd put it all in their response to the white paper, call for evidence and their advice to the government. So I think it's just a case of finalising something they'd already drafted. Some of the, you know, some of the other items from the white paper are probably going to take a bit longer to be finalised. So yeah, I do think having this in place by next summer is realistic.
It's kind of like buying a birthday card and just having it in your drawer in advance, because it already says happy birthday in it, doesn't it? You just got to scribble the name in at the top.
Have to sign your name.
Dear United Kingdom, lots of love. Gambling Commission.
Exactly.
It's probably not my best example ever, but yeah. I can't come up with gold all the time.
Yeah, they didn't just start putting pen to paper after the white paper on this. It's the situation.
Interesting. I mean, I don't think it's going to be on time, because I think there's an awful lot could happen between now and then for this government. Awful lot.
For sure. I mean, the financial checks, it doesn't rely on the government, to be fair. It's just the Gambling Commission are now taking this one. They need to put it into the RCCP. As you say, a lot can happen. They've got a lot of other things on their plate as well. So it could well be the case they get a load of responses in
Is there no part of the consultation process that involves like an APPG or similar? Or am I thinking of the bit that comes before this?
Yeah, not for this. This particular one is now just for the Gambling Commission to finalise and put into the LCCP.
All the other stuff
some of the other stuff involves, some of it involves primary legislation. Those bits will take longer. Mostly for the government, it's secondary legislation. So like the slots limit, the statutory levy, things like that. So it's just probably that they draft the legislation and then there's a chance for anyone to object to it before it gets made into legislation. Sorry, that's anyone in Parliament to object to it, and then it gets made into legislation. So that's the process for most of the DCMS things. Some of the casino changes, so the increased numbers of slot machines and the moving areas for some of the casinos may take a bit longer, because that I think involves some primary legislation, needs to be debated and so on.
Because there was some quite interesting stuff then around the land-based casino. So there was the increase in slots. The one that jumped out to me, I think, was they can take sports bets as well now, or they will.
So currently the small and large casinos can take sports bets. So they're going to introduce that for the converted 1968 Act casinos, which are most of them, obviously. I think that will be, hopefully, as of a positive opportunity for casinos to sort of diversify their offering a bit. They will need to get new licenses from the Gambling Commission to cover that activity. But hopefully that's straightforward for them. And obviously, the increase in machine numbers should be a positive thing. And it's an optional thing. So the casino can choose, do they want to take advantage of it? And it comes with higher license fees. It comes with kind of minimum area requirements to have gaming tables and non-gambling areas. But I would anticipate a lot of them would want to take advantage of the additional slots. What else is there? So cashless payments as well on gaming machines. That could also be positive development. Makes it a bit more frictionless for customers to play. The possibility to move those small and large licenses that haven't been taken up to new areas, that hasn't been put into a consultation yet. Hopefully that one's coming in the next few months as well.
Okay, and then the third big one was the restrictions on the slot games, I think.
Yeah, that's right. So, and I suppose Like, in a way, these two come together because it was part of this idea of leveling the playing field between land-based and online gaming. So along with allowing more slot machines, cashless payments and so on in the land-based casinos, there's this proposal to restrict the stakes on online slots. And you know, the final figure still to be confirmed on that, but it does look like, I think from the wording of the consultation, that either the £5 or the £10 limit would be chosen. The £5 has the benefit of matching the maximum stake in a casino on a slot machine, but it would affect, I think, quite a lot of play comparatively, whereas the £10 limit would have quite a lot less of an impact on online casinos and on sort of the number of stakes at that level that are taking place now. So yeah, I'm not sure which of those it will be. I think it could go either way at the moment. And then yeah, then in addition to the slots, there's quite a few of the restrictions that are currently on online slots are being expanded to all online gaming. Things like the sort of the quick stop features would be expanded to sort of, you know, roulette online, blackjack, and there's also going to be a minimum game speed. There has to be at least 5 seconds with each sort of game cycle, each stake that the player puts on. Ban on autoplay. And the sort of the celebration of a win that isn't really a win because you've won less than you staked or the same amount as you staked, that will also be extended to games other than slots. So yeah, quite a package of restrictions, I think, for online casinos, in addition to the, you know, to balance out the benefits for the land-based casinos.
Yeah. So you could really, so on the, on, so to really then the, because all of that, this was all really well signaled well in advance, so it won't be a surprise. And then really what it's all going to come down to is the shouting match over the max stake. And based on the land-based, team land-based doing so well so far, you could imagine they'll also get this one over the line and have everything sync up between online and offline.
Yeah, I think
it's kind of what it feels like.
There's a compelling reason to go for the £5 stake, but equally you do kind of get the sense from the consultation that DCMS is kind of live to the kind of the potential impact of too low a stake, and that the risk of customers moving to unlicensed black market operators.
I suppose you'd really need to see the data, right? To see like how many people are actually betting more than £5 a stake.
Yeah, they have got some figures in the consultation. I'm afraid I won't be able to remember them off the top of my head. Okay. But it's quite a drop off. So there's I can't remember the figures, but there's quite a lot more would be affected by the £5 limit than the £10 limit. And obviously they've plumped these particular figures, so there's not any chance now of, I don't think, of, you know, £7.50 or something like that. So yeah, and I think they should probably go for the £10 because I do think there is a real risk of the black market. You know, it's been downplayed a lot, but you know, I can really see there's quite a number of stakes affected by a £5 limit, and it's relatively easy to find somewhere you can stake more. I think that will
the crypto casinos would have an absolute blast. So they would, they'd be so happy.
Exactly. So, you know, we'll see. I'd probably go for £10 if I had to predict, but we'll see.
Yeah. Could politics have an influence on that? So, like, obviously, we can say, okay, there's players, there's potential of offshore, but can there be a politician who just doesn't want to be the one who does the £10? Like, because it's such an easy one to, you're not going to lose any votes. And then you can say, right, we've standardized everything. We've done it. It's nice, niche, tidy, no exceptions. Everything's much stricter than it was. We've thought of the children type scenario. Could that play out with this?
Yeah, potentially. Yeah, you could see the government wanting to be seen to be taking sort of strict action on online casinos. Equally, I think, you know, we saw in the white paper overall, I think quite a balanced approach, and that I didn't get the impression that it was just sort of a vote winning thing or, you know, bandwagon or anything like that. It felt like the government was really aware of what the risks were if they go too far with the regulation. So, I can see that would kind of influence people's thinking on, you know, which way they felt it would go. I can imagine there'd be quite a lot of responses to this consultation with people arguing for one or the other, and they'll have to spend quite a bit of time weighing those up.
Okay, just interesting, because there is kind of, I was trying to think of the name. We had a great guy on a year or so. Trying to remember, he had the PhD and he did the book. It was a really good book. It was like the history of...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he had a really interesting line about like the history of political parties trying to regulate gambling from the perspective of poor people don't know how to behave themselves. I'm paraphrasing badly. But it's that kind of very condescending view of just, you know, the lower classes just can't be trusted. We know John can't, but that's which is why, I don't know, I just feel like it's going to be, like, if you take that mentality, it's just like fiver. That's it. I could see it happening. But I don't know anything, so I'm just...
Eventually I think it will swing back the other way. Like we had when around the time the Gambling Act was first coming into force, everyone was sort of, I guess, a bit more, you know, liberal feeling. Mm. Oh, you know, great that we're going to regulate online gambling, and maybe a bit more like it is in the States at the moment, that people are just excited about the opportunity to take part. And then kind of gradually goes the other way, and people are seeing the dangers of it. But then if it becomes over-restricted at some point in the future, you know, there may be some liberalisation, you know, whole new regime, a whole new gambling act, kind of change of the approach.
Or it's an argument that the land-based casino max bet can be increased. Will be the other way to look at it. And it was Dr. Seamus Murphy.
I was going to say Seamus, but I thought I don't want to jump in.
He's from with that kind of name, but he was fantastic.
Almost certainly Welsh.
Strong Welsh name, that.
Strong Welsh flex on his library card. I think with the limits and all that, I think what you're going to see is, I think what they've done is they've put this potential range out there, and it would just fall right in the middle of it. I think it would just be, well, could have been worse. Right in the middle. See, everybody's happy. I think that's what they're setting up for.
Or everyone's slightly unhappy. That kind of, like, where everyone's a bit pissed off, but that'll do. That's the actual.
That's when you know you've got a good deal.
Exactly. So they can say to both sides, could have been worse.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I reserve the right to be wrong.
At least with the gambling consultation, it feels like we've got some real information about what's going to be put in place. But the government's still kind of kicking it down the road, aren't they? Let's wait and see what everyone thinks.
And then ignore it. So everybody, honestly, no, we'll read the emails. We will. Yeah, right. Not that I'm being critical of the sitting government, our political overlords, fabulous group of people. As a top legal mind in the gambling industry, Mel, do you have much dealing with government? Are they on the phone to you saying, Mel, what do we do now?
No, I mean, that would be really cool, actually. Yeah, if they got in touch and said, can you help us draft this legislation? Maybe that would be a conflict of interest. I don't know.
I long for the day when they contact me, because I'll be like, finally, you phoned the right person. Let's get this done.
Let's book a weekend at Checkers and really work through this.
I charge £1 million an hour, but luckily it's only going to take us half an hour. Might want to bring a notebook. But yeah, I've often said that there's some operators I could have saved a fortune for, because when you see the plan for a new casino opening, I just wish they'd phone me up so I can say, lads, don't do it. It's a shit idea. Here's why. I could have saved several operators an absolute fortune, but nobody ever asks.
You should talk to Paul.
Paul Skelfer of GRS Recruitment, Gaming Recruitment Solutions.
Yeah, so when he's not busy finding people their ideal dream job in the gambling industry, he's a casino consultant. He does lots of that
stuff. He is. He very much is. And he was GM and all sorts when he was... As I believe I said before, I first met him when he was running Aspers in Newcastle, which is a great venue.
Oh.
Probably still is. I don't know. I haven't been for a while.
I feel like I found myself in the middle of an ad break. Is this?
It's not an ad break, Mel. It's more of a lifestyle guidance section. So, Mel, if you know anybody that's looking for a position within the gambling industry, we happen to know just the right people. But Fintan, I just can't remember the web address. Can you?
grs-recruit.com.
Oh, yes, of course. It is a hyphen. Thanks, Fintan.
No worries, Joe.
So, Mel, just, you know, if you think of anybody, that'd be great, because we think we know the right people for them to talk to. They're not just corporate overlords to us. They're lovely. Loveliness overlords. Yeah. So anyway, what were we talking about? Have you made any interesting cakes recently, Melanie?
I haven't actually, although I told you about the delicious Norwegian cinnamon buns last time.
Yep.
And my husband had a day at work where everybody had to bring in some sort of food stuff from their kind of cultural heritage. So he decided, because he's got red hair, so he decided he was obviously descended from some sort of Viking stock, therefore he would make these cinnamon rolls.
That is a hell of a reach there.
But it doesn't count as cultural appropriation, so it's fine.
But the whole idea was slightly dodgy. Anyway, of course, then he can't figure out how to wind these up into the right shape, so guess who had to step in and help make all these cinnamon buns. But
wow.
And I bet they were a big hit as well.
Yeah. I think they did all get eaten up.
Yeah. And then he didn't mention he had a, you know, he didn't do it himself and he took all the credit, and yeah. That's
He sounds like a boss. That's what they do. You know, you come up with the idea for, I don't know, off the top of my head, say some awards event, and then everybody else gets the credit and keeps the money. I mean, that is just a completely random thing that I thought of. It's completely random. Mm-hmm. I'm just kidding. But that is what bosses do, apparently. Not all of them. I'm not bitter yet. I'm working on bitter. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. If anybody's listening from there, I'm just kidding. I'm just joshing. Just having a laugh. grs-recruit.com, was it, Fintan? I got it. I've written it down.
Good, man.
I'm good. Melanie Ellis, is there anything that we've missed out there? Do you know what I didn't tell you? I did some homework for this recording. Jesus. I watched 1.5 seasons of The Lincoln Lawyer on Netflix.
Oh, is it any good? I started watching the first episode and I just couldn't get into it? Is it?
It's pretty brain dead television. I think.
Is it like the John Grisham of television? Is that what you're saying?
No, it's not quite that bland. But it is heading down. Let me put it this way. I'm not buying the books.
Okay. Oh, it's based on a book, is it?
Yeah, based on a series of books. And it also, the central conceit, like this guy is so busy that he does his lawyering in his fucking car, which is a Lincoln. I was expecting him to be based in Skegness. But no, apparently there's some American car called a Lincoln. And he's hardly in the car. Let me put it that way. It's the most tenuous thing. It's bizarre. It's a really bizarre gimmick that's completely unused, pretty much. That God, I'm so busy. I'm going to have to do my lawyering from my vehicle.
Really strange. Is he driving at the same time while he's doing it?
No, he's not. He's not. He's got a nice lady driving for him, but.
Okay.
He's also, like, in the first episode, he inherits this, like, law firm.
Chauffeured around.
Yeah. But he inherits this law firm from, like, some dead dude. And that's him getting back. He's getting back in the game. And then he's in the office all the time. But he parks his Lincoln in the parking garage. The fuck?
It's probably a case of... Go on.
Very funny. I was going to say, well, like, why doesn't he get rid of the chauffeur and hire, like, you know, an assistant to, you know, kind of a lawyer to help the workload?
Well, he's already got a trainee lawyer, which is his second ex-wife, and her fiance is his investigating detective bloke, and he's got a recovering addict lady who he helped in the first or second episode as his driver. So he's reasonably well covered. But big swanky offices as well in Los Angeles, I think.
But it's probably just something really practical with filming. So probably in the books, he does it all from the back of the car. But filming car scenes and making it look real is actually quite tough. And from a like logistics perspective, it's much easier if he's in the office because then we can have a set and it's done.
It's considerably cheaper.
Much easier lighting. Well, because even if it's just a car on rollers and you got the fake background and stuff, it gets really fake really quickly. Even with 4K screens and all that kind of stuff. So it's.
But probably, also, it is still just a shit idea.
Have you seen Better Call Saul?
I have not. Only because I haven't seen Breaking Bad. Either.
You don't need to see Breaking Bad. You'll get some of the Easter eggs in it, but you don't need to see Breaking Bad. It's really good.
But I don't eat chocolate.
Wait.
See what I did there?
I did. Man of puns. Puntastic.
What, is he in his car a lot?
He has a car. I think it's a Camino or something like
that. Oh, yeah.
Or it's a crap car. Anyway.
Okay. Well, I don't know. I don't know, Fenton.
It's okay.
The lawyering in the car thing. I mean, I feel like the Lincoln lawyer's got that nailed.
It's his gimmick. Nobody else can take a call from the car.
Yeah. There is that. I mean, there are movies with lots of car stuff in, like lots of scenes in cars and, you know. So it can be done. Like there's that Tom Hardy movie, I think it's called Lock. And the entire movie is in a car on a phone.
Just the Blues Brothers. Right? Best car movie ever made.
It's not, but I appreciate you saying that. Orange whip. It's actually my favorite. It's like probably the least quoted line from the Blues Brothers, but it's my favorite for some reason. John Candy, top man. That's just a shout out to all our Canadian listeners. Big growth market for us, Fenton.
Yeah.
And I think probably Mad Max 2 or Mad Max Fury Road would be the ideal model for a car, an extended car scene. If the Lincoln lawyer was in a desolate, parched wasteland where people are fighting for water and fuel, then it would probably be a considerably better series.
you know, he's negotiating water rights contracts.
It's perfectly harmless, don't get me wrong. But there's also no compelling reason to watch it. The water cooler conversation the next day will be, see the Lincoln lawyer? Yeah. Yeah, what did you think of that bit where he was parking his Lincoln? Yeah, it's really good. And then that woman off Scream, she was in that bit. Did you see her when she did that? Yeah.
So you got through a season and a half of this?
Well, it's like the John Grisham principle, Fintan. You know, I've read 8 John Grisham books now and none of them have been any good. One of them was not awful, but that's not the same as being good. And so I've got 3 left to read. Because I figure if I read more than 11, it's going to count as some form of self-abuse, self-harm. I don't want one of the listeners to have me sectioned, because maybe we've got some John Grisham fans listening. I don't know. I took a similar approach with The Lincoln Lawyer. I'm like, I can't just dismiss this after a couple of episodes. I'm going to tough it out so Fintan doesn't have to.
How is something like John Grisham viewed within the legal community?
Fintan!
I don't think I've ever discussed John Grisham with another lawyer. Probably we all secretly
that's your
bail, and you know that's what got
some. That is your homework for between now and your next podcast appearance. We need a straw poll of your peers.
Do you enjoy lawyer John Grisham? It surprises me how many kind of works of fiction and TV series are based on being a lawyer, because ultimately it's really not like fun. You know, it's just sitting at a desk, amending documents, drafting reports. It's kind of, you know, it's not exciting in any way. So it's a weird one.
We may have just lost Melanie.
I think I'm still here.
Yeah, you're back. You're back.
You're back in the room. I get what you're saying. And I don't doubt that you're right. There's this dude, I read a few of his books because they were so funny. Imagine a John Grisham thriller that is actually fun and interesting. I don't know if you can quite picture that. But what he does is he takes like a typical lawyer thing, like, oh, I've got to represent this dude. Right. Oh, this Russian mobster wants representing. Oh, well, I got to pay my bills kind of thing. And then he introduces some absolutely completely fucking bizarre little, almost like if it was in music, it would be a motif. So in the Russian mobster one, they strap a bomb to his back. And when a certain person's going to be on the stand, he's going to be cross-examining them. He's going to have to walk over to them, and then they're going to detonate the bomb. It's phenomenal. It's like, imagine if John Grisham had a sense of humor or some sense of pace. But he doesn't. But at least, I mean, they're terrible, but at least those books are fun to read. Anyway, sorry. So, Melanie, have you read any John Grisham yourself?
I have definitely. When I was a teenager, I think I worked my way through them all, and I must have enjoyed them. I can't remember the plot of any of them now, and I certainly haven't read any for a good few years.
Is it not a required module at lawyer university?
Funnily enough, but yeah,
I can't tell you.
Has read them.
I'm so disappointed to hear that it's not a part of the curriculum.
Maybe in the States it is. I don't know.
I would certainly hope so. If any American lawyers are listening, if you could let us know the status of that nice Mr. Grisham. The amount of detail he goes into about private jets, I can't help but read some of them and just think, he's written this one to upgrade his jet.
It's a paid product placement.
Yeah.
That's an idea.
See, I'm just thinking about my car right now. But anyway.
You need to get writing.
We're in the market for a jet, people, if you're listening.
Yeah. But just imagine the branding, how good we'd look on that. I mean, that would be pretty good.
The two silhouettes on the tail? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Pull up beside the Iron Maiden jet. Brilliant.
Now you're talking. I could have a chat with Iron Maiden because they phoned up. I told you this before. They phoned up the magazine that I was editing, a DVD magazine.
Oh, yeah.
Because one of my guys reviewed one of their DVDs and he was critical of the sound mastering.
Oh.
Which was a very fair criticism because most music DVDs at that point were mixed in 5.1. And they phoned up to talk to him and explain why the audio was the way it was. Because it turned out they were subscribers to the magazine and they were big fans and they felt really bad.
That's good.
Good times. Melanie Ellis, thank you very, very much for joining us and sharing your mad, mad skills.
You're welcome. Yeah, have me back again one day, maybe.
Hell yeah. If you've enjoyed this episode of the Gambling Files podcast, please find us on LinkedIn. Give us a big, juicy, succulent like. That nearly went wrong. You can find us under the name The Gambling Files Podcast. You can find us on Twitter under The Gambling Files. I think the handle is just @GamblingFiles. You can connect to myself, John Bruford, or Fintan Costello, also on LinkedIn. We're also both on Twitter. And you can find all of our previous episodes at www.thegamblingfiles.com. If you enjoyed it, please share. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell your colleagues, and we'll see you next time.